Indie rocker icons The Blake Babies, John Strom, Frida Love Smith, and Juliana Hatfield. And live coverage of the final night of the Republican National Convention. And now, here's your host, a man who is hoping that Donald Trump improvises his entire speech, Justin Kaufman.
Can I get a suggestion?
We all know. We all want it. That's the beauty of it, right? We don't want this. I see this script is leaked. Nobody wants a leaked script. What's this script stuff? We thought this was going to be off the cuff, Donald. The Donald we've come to love. Don't do this to us, Donald. Don't turn into one of the suits. Well, you do wear suits. Maybe that's not. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on 720 WGN Radio. Wow. What a night tonight. The Republican nominee for the president will be speaking, accepting the nomination tonight, the final day of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. We'll be all over it. We'll carry the speech live. Charles Lipson and Chris Roebling will be back in studio. We'll check in with Andrea Darlis and others in Cleveland. A lot to do tonight. Tell us what you think, too. 312-981-7200. We'll take calls. We'll take your texts. I'll try my best to respond to those texts. Got a great, great night ahead of us here on WGN Radio. We're going to start all that up around 8:30. I think that's appropriate, don't you, Pete? I mean, I think that that's about the right time. Because if you start now, you just turn into CNN.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's the same placard, the same. I keep saying, well, what we know right now is that Donald Trump will be speaking tonight. Are we excited? Let's turn. Are you excited?
Yeah, I think 8:30 is fine.
Yeah.
I mean,
it might even be too early.
I was talking with Rob earlier about when do you think that Trump will begin his speech. And we weren't really sure. 9 o'clock probably for the most viewers. Listeners?
Yeah, I mean, that's 10 o'clock in Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
You know. Last night, Mike Pence went on stage around 9:42. I remember that because we're coming out of the news. And it's interesting because, like, I just kind of joked at the top that this is a sort of leak of, you know, the script. The script has been leaked, which is not really accurate. Leak is different than...
It's been given. To the media.
It's been given to
the
media.
To talk about for
and they
the
said,
next
here
couple
you go.
Of hours.
They said, we'd like to give this to the national media. Here you go. Here is his speech. What's a better way to say this? We really need to drum up support. What could we do to make it seem like they're continuing to be bumble? You know? Oh, what if we say it's leaked? That makes it seem like maybe they made a mistake. We'll take it right out of the teleprompter. Good.
Bingo.
Keep going with it. I like it. Roger Ailes is like, I've got to go. It's my last time here, but good job, guys. Yeah, leaked. Come on. Nothing's leaked anymore.
I guess the thing with Pence, too, it seemed his speech was good, and it seemed like it was a nice length. I don't know how long Donald is going to speak. Is he going to – how long do these usually go?
I would say
30
he's
minutes?
Got to go 30, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, if we follow the logic that the script that was given to the media just about a half an hour ago, if that – or an hour ago now. But if that is the script, it's not that long of a script. It's not that long of a speech. But just a question, and I think the question we still want to know – is and Rob mentioned it yesterday. Is Donald Trump going to go off script?
Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be moments where he decides he wants to interject something? He wants to tell people he's a winner. You know, is it not in the speech enough that he's a winner? Maybe in his head he's like, you have not doubled down. You have not fortified. You have not let everyone know that you're a winner. You need to do it again. One more time. He's got someone in his ear. I go back to The Apprentice. I talk about The Apprentice. I'm so excited about it. You know, I'm not usually someone who's that excited and geeked up about political speeches. But this is one that, I mean, we talked about last night is 13 months in the making. Everyone can continue to write off Donald Trump, and here he is, mm-hmm. even up to the point where they were talking about he's not even going to make it through this convention. That, you know, it's going to be a brokered convention.
Right, yeah.
He won't even make it out of this convention. And here he is tonight, and ready to address the United States of America on why he should be the next president of the United States. We'll do all that coming up at 8:30. I'm excited about it. Last night was so, so fun to be in the room with political pundits and analysts when they're watching a script, something that no one expects. When the boos start coming in to watch how wide-eyed Chris Roebling got, he's not going to endorse him. I mean, he starts screaming in the studio. It's just so electric. And it's I hope that we have some of those moments again. Maybe not. If it all goes to plan, there won't be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll have a very stated cerebral analysis tonight.
Nah.
All right, so that's coming up at 8:30. Coming up at 7:30, though, this is unbelievable for me and for us as a WGN nation here to have the Blake Babies in studio. The Blake Babies, if you're not familiar, was one of the original college rock bands. College rock, just like microbreweries used to be turned to craft beer, indie rock used to be college rock. That's the way. And the Blake Babies were a Boston-based band, Frieda Love Smith, John Strom, and Juliana Hatfield, that started in 1986 in Boston. And they this year are turning 30 years old. They've got a project where they're releasing some of the demos from their seminal album, Earwig. If anyone is a WXRT fan, a college rock fan, they know the Blake Babies. They know Juliana Hatfield. Juliana Hatfield had her solo career, obviously, with the trio and with herself. And also, both John and Juliana played with the Lemonheads, It's a Shame About Ray, and albums after that. So this band, which broke up in 1990, they actually predate the alternative sort of explosion, the 120 minutes MTV explosion where we saw bands like Smashing Pumpkins and Urge Overkill and bands like that sort of come out of Chicago. Well, that was happening everywhere, and they were broken up by then. Juliana Hatfield and Frieda and John's band Antenna were able to actually have some, to get some bump from that explosion, but also the Blake Babies. After they broke up, they got bigger than they ever were when they were together. And so we'll talk about that with them in studio. They are back together 30 years later to work on this project, releasing demos, and they're doing a handful of shows. And they're not regular shows. It's not like they're at Metro. They're really doing intimate shows with it's all through their Pledge Music campaign, 20, 30, 40, 50 people at a time to hear them play music together again. It's amazing. And I think it's awesome. They are going to come in studio. Kudos to Pete Zimmerman for making it happen. How about that? It's so great to have them here. I mean, to talk about that generation, that music, talk about where they're at now. These are bona fide rock stars to be in studio talking about their music. It's great. It's also great for me and my 19-year-old self, who I remember buying Earwig in Rose Records in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Oh, yeah, maybe we'll try this one out. Oh, this is the early stuff. The song Cesspool is on that record. Such good stuff, man, all the way through. Blake Babies are great. And I think it's kind of fitting because today is my dad's birthday, his 70th birthday. Happy birthday, Dad.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, one thing that my dad did for me is he gave me his Dodge Colt, his 1985 Dodge Colt when I turned
for his 18. Birthday. He gave
yeah,
you
this,
a
was, this was years ago. You know, he gave it to me when I turned a certain. I needed a car,
mm-hmm.
and he was so dad such a. I'll tell you how great my dad is, and this is a good story for all the dads out there. My dad made me buy my car, right? So it was the old car, the family car, and I got it was a Dodge Colt hatchback. Classic.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, great. Muffler was gone. Real nice car. But so I would pay, I think it was, I'd have to pay my dad $20 a week, I think it was, for the car. So I'd pay him like by month, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
like, for
teaching the car, you some responsibility.
And then when I turned 30, he gave me all that money back.
Are you serious?
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah.
Like, with interest?
It was like, I forgot what it was, like $5,000 or some, $10,000 or something like that. But he's like, here, I didn't take the money. I just put it in a bank account.
That is amazing.
Isn't that cool? I know, I'm going to do the same thing for my son. That's awesome. Anyway, the Dodge Colt. The one thing about the Dodge Colt is there was an ability, I think it was I put a new stereo in. It was a tape player. And it had the ability to actually, you know, have you plug the headphones in and you could get the CD Walkman to play through it. So I would go from Wonder Lake, Illinois, to the Crystal Lake train station to take that train in my first year of college at Columbia College. It was like a four-hour commute. And that Walkman would go everywhere with me, that CD Walkman. It was the Blake Babies. It was Sunburn. The record Sunburn that was on all the time. I ruined that record. Ruined it. Scratched. I couldn't get it to play. I had to spin it. almost like a record, like a turntable, like spin the CD to get it to work because it was the old, like, it had the spin. So it was like, So anyway, I know these records back and forth based on that commute, that four-hour commute that I had to Columbia College back in 1992, 1993. So I'm looking forward to talking to them. We talked with Frida when she had her memoir/cookbook out. Great stories about growing up in that kind of music, and we'll continue with the band who are playing at Space on Saturday afternoon, limited engagement. So we'll talk with the Blake Babies coming up after the news at 7:30. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier. Big night for all that. At least news and weather. I don't know what the traffic situation is, but news and weather, you're going to check in with Rob. We will definitely check in with him all night. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right. Let's get the download started tonight. Big night here on the show. So why don't we start with the carryout? Start like this every night. It's where I read the newspaper. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Donald Trump will wrestle tonight at the main event. Oh, sorry, no. He'll be speaking at the main event, the culmination of the Republican National Convention. Will Trump deliver a scripted speech? Will he go out of his way to slam Ted Cruz? Will he eat a sandwich while delivering said speech? Will he cuss? Will he air kiss his daughter? Whatever he does end up doing with tonight, it's the biggest must-watch speech, well, since the last one. Texas Senator Ted Cruz brought the House down last night by not endorsing Trump, and this morning made it clear he did it as revenge, saying he didn't like the attacks against his father and his wife, and then he said he's not some sort of servile puppy. Servile. I mean, I get the vile part, but servile? New word. Trump has already gotten himself in hot water today as he told the media that if president, he would only conditionally support NATO allies if attacked. Essentially, he quoted Eddie Murphy from Raw saying, "What have you done for me lately, Eddie?" This angered military backers on both sides of the aisle. But then again, isn't that what a president's supposed to do? Be hated by politicians but loved by people? I mean, he's halfway there. Word is that tomorrow Hillary Clinton will announce her pick for vice president. All say it's going to be Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. That's not going to be popular among leftist Democrats who were hoping for someone more progressive. But then again, when has Hillary ever cared about Democrats? It's official. Roger Ailes is out at Fox News after allegations of sexual harassment. It leaked he was out early in the week and he was walking with $40 million. But today reports are that he's going to walk with $60 million. So let me get this straight. He sexually harassed his employees and essentially negotiated a raise? Wow. Society, just the worst. The NBA announced today that they're pulling the 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte because of North Carolina's law on gender-matching bathrooms. This disproportionately affects the LGBT community, and the NBA feels the law is discriminatory. Rajon Rondo and Kobe Bryant were like, "Yeah, we agree." Right? Please forgive us. A plane crashed into a house in Joliet today. The pilot was killed. The first reports had the plane crashing in Plainfield, which got news headline writers way too excited. A plane crashed in Plainfield? Oh, please make it so. It's Joliet. No. Workers at a Southside Burger King walked out today because the AC broke in the kitchen. Good thing they make those Whoppers hours in advance. Who needs workers? Be a bigger story if the heat lamps walked out. In weather, hot. Way too hot. My knees sweat today. Thunderstorms on deck, you know, because nothing beats the heat like hot rain. Ooh, hot rain. Good name for the new Steven Seagal movie. Steven Seagal is hot rain. No? In sports, the White Sox have to play in this heat tonight. They take on the Tigers at the Cell. We need to choose between two mottos for the remainder of the season. One, it starts now. Or two, sure, we'll take cash considerations. The Sox are looking to sell off pieces like David Robertson and maybe Todd Frazier, possibly ending his legendary career on the South Side, which spans over four whole months. The Cubs have the day off. They get back at it tomorrow against the Brew Crew. Good news, Dexter Fowler, free range, looks to be back in action. The Cubs have missed him. They did their little slide almost at the exact time that he went down with a hammy. And we missed his cool hip-hop walk-up music, too. Fetty Wap. Starting Monday, the Cubs and Sox will start a four-game set. Did they figure out how to get Arrieta and Sale matched up on the same day? I'm not good at math, so figure it out. And yes, I will be mad if that does not happen. It's not that hard to do. You do it if you cared about us. Donald Trump would do it. Tomorrow, Charles Peanut Tillman will re-sign with the Bears to promptly retire with the Bears. Great gesture, but any way that we might be able to convince him to do one more year? I mean, the Bears front office has been reliable at screwing up paperwork in the past. Maybe just trick him into having to at least play special teams? I'm just not ready for a game without Peanut. In Bulls news, backup point guard Aaron Brooks signed with the Indiana Pacers. I feel like the Pacers are the closest thing to the Packers in basketball. So it annoys me to no end when Bulls players end up on the Pacers, right? CJ Watson went there. You have successfully destroyed all Chicago memories. Are you happy, Aaron Brooks? I don't even know who you are. Good day. I said good day. Good day. Finally, Facebook announced that they're getting into the drone business. They're going to invest in giant drone airplanes, which will serve as internet satellites to provide internet everywhere. And wait till they're able to equip those drones with missiles? Try and leave that Facebook comment now, troll. They'll miss. That's the carryout for July 21st, 2016. Hey, it's so hot out tonight that we're closing down the grill. But no worries, raw chicken's all the rage these days. Coming up, we're going to have the Blake Babies in studio talking about their reunion show that's going to be at Space this Saturday afternoon. Talk about re-releasing the Earwig demos. Oh, this is going to be fun on vinyl. The band is here. Stay with us. 720 WGN. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8:30, we are going to start our coverage of the Republican National Convention. Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson will be back, and we will bring you the speech, the Donald Trump speech, live here on 720 WGN. But first, earlier this month, a select group of music lovers were given a rare treat. Less than 100 people crowded into a Boston studio to hear a special reunion of the 80s college rock trio, Blake Babies. Blake Babies hit the Boston music scene alongside bands like the Lemonheads and the Pixies. Just to name a few, they had much success, and unlike many young bands of its time, broke up shortly thereafter. I say way too early. But this band is one that seemed to grow a bigger fan base after the breakup. This in large part to the alternative rock explosion of the early 90s, and because those fans were introduced to band members' new projects. The trio, of course, consists of guitarist John Strom, drummer Frieda Love Smith, and bass player and vocalist Juliana Hatfield. Juliana put out solo records and had mainstream success with the Juliana Hatfield 3, and John and Frieda played in the band Antenna. Since then, the influential rock band went their own way. Hatfield continues a tour and just recently started up the three again, and is in a project with the Replacements' Paul Westerberg's, the I Don't Cares. Frieda Love Smith is living in Evanston, writing and teaching at Northwestern. You may remember that she was on our program, this program right here, with her memoir slash cookbook, Red Velvet Underground, which just came out. And John Strom is now a Nashville-based entertainment lawyer. The group is back together for a time. They've launched a new Pledge music campaign around a vinyl release of the Earwig demos. Earwig was the Blake Babies' 1988 album released by Mammoth Records. And they're playing a special intimate show Saturday afternoon at Space in Evanston. Doors open at 1 o'clock. The Blake Babies were formed in 1986. That's 30 years ago.
We're old.
30th anniversary. In studio with me tonight, Frieda Love Smith, John Strom, Juliana Hatfield, Blake Babies. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks. Nice to be here. This is Juliana, by the way.
There we go. We've got it.
This is Frieda.
This is John.
All right. So let's talk about the, I mean, John, why don't we start with you? I mean, I'm interested in how this kind of came about, the idea of the demos. They sort of been dusted off from a basement shelf somewhere.
Right. Well, I came into possession of the 2-inch tape and without really realizing it. And I had a bunch of 2-inch, you know, these are the master tapes for albums he used to make back then when people recorded on tape. It's like a big box, that 2-inch tape. So my friend Paul Mahern, who was one of the producers of the Blake Babies, he did the Rosie Jack World EP, called me up and said they're shutting down their storage facilities, a nice climate-controlled storage facility in Bloomington, and he wanted to know what I wanted him to do with all these tapes.
And maybe so a couch. You know,
right, so he was coming to Nashville, so he brought me just a trunk full of tapes and just dropped them off of my porch. And most of them were what I expected them to be. There were a couple of Antenna albums and some of my solo stuff. And then there was this one reel of Blake Babies that I had no idea what it was. And I opened it up, and it's a 24-track tape, and we'd recorded three sets of 8-tracks on the tape. So it was kind of a jumbled mess. And I took it to a friend to bounce to digital and then to another friend to mix. And when we finally got it cleaned up and mixed, it was really, really good. You know, we all listened to it and said, this is actually great. We should do something with it.
Were you surprised by that? I mean, you're surprised that they held up after almost 28 years, Frieda?
Definitely surprised, and surprised that it seemed like something we might actually want to share with people, because you don't make demos with that intention
right.
at all. But it sounded like it really represented the band during a period of time that's not that well documented, and it held up surprisingly well.
Yeah, I guess this is pre-internet.
Exactly, 1988.
Yeah.
When you hear that recording you just played, that was the album that resulted, and that was a song we wrote later, so that wasn't on the demos. But basically what we did is we went in with our brand new producer, Gary Smith, who's a brilliant guy, and he was, you know, it was really a great break for the band. And he brought us into the studio and just set up mics and had us play our set. And then he used that as a production tool. He listened to that, and we listened to it together, and we made changes and produced the record, which, you know, if for people who aren't familiar with the process, the producer of a record is much like the director of a film. He got very involved, went to our practices, changed things, and, you know, we wrote new parts. But that recording is how we sounded in a club at that time, presented really well, recorded by the same guy that recorded the first Radiohead album, you know, a brilliant engineer, so... It's a really cool memento.
Juliana, when John said, hey, I got these tapes, we should do something with it, what was your first response to the idea of these demos being unearthed and brought to the public?
I think my brain just sort of shut down. I really had a strange, like, mental and emotional block about it. Like, I just sort of thought, like, okay, whatever, yeah, do it. I can't deal with this. Like, I couldn't...
That's
at
okay.
first,
yes.
I couldn't go there. I couldn't just go back and listen right away, just because I thought it would be too hard to hear stuff that I hadn't heard in that long. Just because it was such a long time ago, and we were so young, and I thought I would be mortified by it. But
mortified, like, because you would be embarrassed by the skill of it, or the emotional experience
of
the time, or bringing you back to that time.
But my own sort of insecurities, you know, worrying that my voice sounded really high and too earnest, worrying that it was going to be so over earnest and embarrassing and just like too raw.
You're more exposed than we are because they're your songs or your lyrics for the most part, and you're the singer, so it's your voice. So it's maybe a little more intense for you to go back.
Yeah, and as you guys know, I was kind of a miserable person back then. I had a lot of emotional problems. I wasn't easy to be around. I was kind of miserable. But I think. Listening back to everything now, I'm actually not at all embarrassed. I'm really proud of it all, and I think that we did really good work and we worked really hard in it. And I was just saying that that stuff, it really doesn't sound dated. I don't think you can hear the 80s in it.
Right.
I think it really still holds up.
It's 28 years old.
We were trying very hard to create something fresh and new. That was the goal, is we wanted to not be influenced and not do anything that was tried or cliched, and we weren't trying to be mainstream. Mainstream music then, we thought, basically was mostly awful.
Well, what would be the mainstream equivalent of Blake Babies at that time? I mean, obviously REM comes to mind, but that was even before
they weren't mainstream.
They weren't mainstream at that point. So who? I mean, what do you even compare that to? The idea of ambition to be mainstream in 1988 when you're putting
mainstream. I don't think there is anything like, because we were just immersed in this scene that, well, it wasn't even a scene. It was just like everyone was kind of doing their own thing, and people were coming out. These original sounds were coming out of people. In Boston, there was, where we were based, there was, you know, like Dinosaur Jr., the Lemonheads, the Pixies, Throwing Muses. They all sounded really different, you know? So, and then the stuff we liked, I think the three of us listened to some of the same stuff, like we all liked REM and The Replacements,
and X,
but then we also had really different tastes in some ways. So I think that when we got together, it was just this mishmash of what was around us and the different things that we liked and the similar things that we liked. So it was really, I think there was no model that we were basing ourselves on. We were trying to create, like John said, we were trying to create our own sound.
The mainstream then was, if you wanted for context, it was like hair metal and
absolutely
or Paul Abdul, stuff like that, and that's what, you know, you can't really
you weren't trying to be Paul Abdul too.
Well, you can't really strive for that, and there was a strange moment where when we started getting courted by major labels around 1990, when Sunburn came out, or maybe before Sunburn came out, there was this strange sort of disconnect, because, like, we worked with one guy who produced the Bangles, and you know, he thought that what we were doing was very consistent with that, and you know, that sounded strange to me, at least. And,
John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield, Blake Babies in studio. They have the the release of the demos of Earwig, their 1988 record. We'll continue the conversation here. We'll take a quick break. So good.
That's fresh, man.
Comes to mind, John, when you hear this song? I mean, what comes to mind to all of you when you hear this music, you know, music that was produced in the late 80s, and you guys have obviously, you know, spent a lot of time away from this stuff?
I get weird sense memories. You know, I remember what it was like sitting in the studio and stuff like that. I mean, it triggers all kinds of stuff. So it's impossible for me to have any distance from it.
Yeah.
I think we were so driven, or I was personally, just so driven, you know, so believing in what we were doing. Did you guys believe in it as hard as I did?
We cared.
We believed
so much.
In it. We cared. And then I can't imagine caring about anything ever again.
Well, I mean, this was, you know, you guys met. It's a famous story of meeting in Boston when you guys were all going to the Berklee School, or around the Berklee School there.
Juliana and I were. Frida was just stealing food from the
cafeteria. That's close enough. That's close enough.
Yeah.
But you know, the story as we talked about it, Frida, and then I've read, is that you guys wanted to work with Juliana, and she walked through the lobby and you walked up to her dorm room and you knocked on the door and said, I want to start a band with you. Yeah, is that true?
Yeah, Frida can tell this one because this was really her deal. I mean, I was up for it and along with it, but it was definitely her deal.
Yeah, I just said, like, we're just going to go knock on her door and we're going to ask her to start a band with us. And she seemed to receive it really calmly and positively.
I think I was waiting for them. I mean, I went to Berkeley because I transferred from Boston University because I really wanted to be in a band, and I was so shy, and I didn't know how to get a band together, and I didn't know how to meet people. And so the fact that you were eating in cafeteria makes up for the fact that I was on the meal plan, but I never ate in the cafeteria.
So it all balances out.
I was too shy to go to the cafeteria to eat.
Omelets. I ate your food.
Yeah.
But so what was I saying?
Well, the idea is you were waiting for them.
Yeah, I went to Berkeley to start a band, but I was too shy to go and meet anyone. So, I mean, I went to my classes, but then I was like, how do people start bands? And I'll just wait and they'll come to me. And then they did. It was kind of like a fantasy.
Yeah, well, we played destiny. That night. We went back to Frida had an apartment down the street, and we had instruments, and we just immediately started playing. And Juliana started playing her songs. Like, here are some songs I have.
I was ready and waiting for.
We had
band
songs.
To come
we're like,
me.
Okay, it's done. It took us about three years to figure out that we didn't need a fourth person. You know, we kept trying to have bass players.
Well, I mean, for you, I mean, when did it go from, this is great, I want to start a band. A band is sort of novel. That's why I'm at this school. That's why I'm going to be a part, to sort of the idea, the ambition of having a career in music, because Blake Babies took off. It wasn't something that, okay, it was fun to play at the club and it was fun to do your classes and then maybe do something on the weekend, but it turned into something where you guys were dedicated to it.
We were dedicated, but it didn't really take off in the way that you sound like you're meaning it. I mean, I remember a lot of struggling, you know, taking the number one bus down Mass Ave to Albany Street, and then we have to walk like another mile to get to this unheated practice space, like carrying my bass for a mile on this dangerous street down to the practice space that was unheated and freezing in the winter. And we had this like really dangerous, it had a really dangerous like propane heater that shot fire out of it.
We should have all died.
There was not a lot of romance there. Now, the thing that kind of baffles me actually is that if you look at like what we were doing, what we were all intent on doing, you know, Frida and I together and Juliana separately, was we wanted to make a band and we wanted to be like the Replacements or something. We wanted to get in a van and go play joints, you know, and make records and put them on independent labels, which was not a career path. I mean, that was not a path to, you know, having a livelihood. And because the biggest you could possibly get, you might get to be in a bus and get hotel rooms. You know, you weren't, you know, sort of able to be a millionaire doing that. And that didn't bother us at all, I don't think. I mean,
we never had a tour bus. The Blake Babies didn't really make money back then.
No, we didn't make much money.
We all worked jobs, we made barely enough. But then, you know, I think what got confusing and one of the reasons why we stopped was because the business changed very quickly and it pivoted on Nirvana's success, you know, around that time. And well, in the Pixies, I mean, there was a path to it, but it went from being underground music was strictly underground to being, you know, it was commerce. It was, you know, it was big
major label
showbiz.
Kind of
and that was, I think, hard to process. And that was around the time the band was getting kind of successful.
Chicago has this lore of an early '90s explosion when it comes to bands like the Smashing Pumpkins.
Very real here,
right?
But it was the kind of thing that I wonder. I've always wondered this about other cities. In Boston, in the time, let's say late '80s, when you're talking about bands like Throwing Muses or Pixies or Blake Babies, Lemonheads. Was it the same kind of thing where the music industry came around, sniffing around to sort of bring bands out of that scene because that scene was so popular?
I think it was maybe a little different in Boston. It seemed like some of those bands got really big in England. Like
Because of 4AD.
The Muses. Yeah, 4AD signed them up, and then they were huge and overseas, but that never happened with us. And I think I don't know what I was going to say, but I feel like I think that a lot of those bands kind of had blew up more than we did in terms of their followings and their critical respect. We were sort of the forgotten middle child.
Yeah, I felt they left us.
Come on, we did fine, you guys. No, there was a great. People liked us. They came to our shows.
Come on.
No, it was.
They were cool. And
Here was the thing. In that time, 1988 in Boston. Yeah. Yes, I mean you go down the list. You got Buffalo Tom. You got Pixies. You got Throwing Muses. Lemonheads. On and on.
Morphine.
All these. Yeah. Morphine. Big Dipper. You've got all these amazing bands. And none of them were really popular yet. There was a moment where I remember we played at the Rat, which is about a 200 capacity club. Us, Throwing Muses, and the Pixies in the same bill, and it was about a third full. And that was totally normal.
Yeah, right,
it was an amazing show. Right, but there was a guy from Melody Maker from England out there, so it was who wrote about it. So it was starting to percolate. But I mean, people didn't care about those bands, but we knew they were great. You know, because we're all music fans, we all had ears, so we're kind of pinching ourselves saying, this is amazing, these bands should all be huge. And then you kind of went to bed one night and woke up the next day and they all were, you know, and that was definitely disorienting, but very cool.
But well, it didn't start that way. I don't remember if we all went, but Dinosaur Jr., when they started out, they were called Dinosaur. And the first album, it just says Dinosaur on it. And the reprints all have Dinosaur Jr., but we went to see them at this place called Green Street Station in Jamaica Plain, and there were like 12 people in the audience, but they were still the best rock band in the world, and Jay was like the best guitar player in the world, and they had their thing totally together in front of 12 people, and it was like it blew my mind. And the fact that there were 12 people in the audience didn't matter. We knew that this was like the greatest band in the world, or I did.
Totally. Well, it didn't. Yeah, you're not like, oh, it must not be happening. There's nobody here. I'll tell you who was there. It was us. It was Beat
the
Happening, you know, Calvin Johnson, who were staying at our place at that time.
That's right.
And it was the Screaming Trees who were opening, you know.
That was the audience.
You know, sort of, that was, and there were about four barflies kind of hanging around. That was the whole thing, you know.
That's great.
It's incredible.
Well,
that's
you know, this is, we're kind of having the official history lesson of Blake Babies here on the download tonight. John Strom, Frieda Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield in studio. We're talking about the release of their Earwig demos. There's a Pledge Music campaign to release those to fans, and they're also doing a Saturday afternoon show, very intimate show at Space in Evanston coming up this Saturday. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Blake Babies in studio. Stay with us. I try to keep it on as long as I can. It brings back such great memories. Blake Babies in studio tonight. John Strom, Frieda Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield. Again, with like this song. I mean, is it a same kind of thing? It takes you back to studio. When you hear this music, when you hear Blake Babies, what is the emotional response? For Frieda, what's the emotional response to you in that song?
Well, it's interesting you should ask me for this song, because this is the one that I mentioned to these guys a couple of times when I was relearning the songs to prepare for these shows. This one really moved me. I actually cried real tears when I was listening to it, and trying to kind of figure out why. And I think it's because it's really passionate and it's really sincere and it's really young in a way that has choked me up and kind of revisiting. But I also like the song, and I don't feel at all like embarrassed or uncomfortable about it either. Like, I really like it.
The funny thing about this song, though, is that it's, well, the way that we used to write songs, and you know, I mean, the way that we wrote songs when we did God Bless, and if we write songs in the future, the way we'll probably write songs is I write, you know, Juliana might write the whole thing, but sometimes I write the music and just hand it to Juliana to finish. And that's the way we wrote this one. So I had the whole piece of music and gave it to her, and she wrote melody and lyrics. I was very happy with the result. But the funny thing is that we did not have fans at this point. You know, this is before we had a record out.
That's true.
Nobody cared about the Blake Babies when we made this song. And she's like pledging to the fans that we're not going to sell out to them. We're going to be true to our, you know, sound and integrity and all
it's
that.
It's so optimistic.
Yeah, just to nobody.
Juliana, when you hear that song, what do you think? I mean, is there an emotional response to it?
Well, kind of. I kind of feel the way Frida feels. I get a little choked up just because we were so earnest and we were so young and we had such hopes and ambitions and we thought that what we were doing was really important and that it was going to set the world on fire, or at least I thought so, that I thought that, you know, this band was going to be really important. And but there's also part of me just hears the technical things. I think about, you know, the sound of my voice and the melody and the guitar sounds, you know, the jang, so jangly. So it, yeah, I have a really a rush of thoughts when I hear mm-hmm. it.
I mean, you guys as musicians, because you've had other projects. I mean, we've been talking in the break about, I mean, obviously you guys have all sort of touched the Lemonheads at one point. You know, talk about the...
Never touched them.
Yeah, don't have touched the Lemonheads. But Antenna, the Julian Hatfield 3. Do you see Blake Babies as... are you able to, in your career, kind of sort of take it out and almost make that like a chapter in your life and you're sort of... be able to put it in a box, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was kind of, it was definitely a period of time, a very intense period of time. But then again, it's hard to believe that it was only a few years that we were together.
I know.
Because it was such a major part of my life and my development and my young womanhood. It really... I still feel it's so vivid to me, all of it, and so when listening to this stuff, it just like comes right, trying to relearn it comes right back to me, like the muscle memory is still there. And so it's like, I don't know if I answered your question.
No, but that's right. 1986 to 1990, right? That's really
91. We made
that.
They were like
5 years.
Eventful and I guess more than that, like heightened kind of time period. Like 4 years is really nothing to me now, but it was everything.
Yeah, it seemed like a really long time. It was really intense 4 years, I think.
Well, for me, from my own experience, because I play music now just for fun. It's a hobby. It's been a long time since I've been pursuing any kind of professional music. And you know, the bands that we had after the Blake Babies, Antenna, Villa Deluxe, those bands, I'm proud of the work we did. I'm proud of the records I made on my own, but I don't think that they were as artistically successful as what we did in the Blake Babies. In Blake Babies, I should say. That's the name.
Get rid of that.
And then in the Lemonheads, I was really just a player. You know, I played drums for a couple years early on. I played guitar for a few years later, but, you know, it was really Evan's band. So, you know, for me, for what I created during my quote-unquote career, it was, you know, this is really the kind of the heart of it.
You know, Juliana, you've said a couple times now, you look back on it and you think about that time, you think about the skill involved. Let me ask you a pretty direct question. What did you learn from being in the Blake Babies?
I learned a lot working with Gary Smith, the producer, just about what producing is and, you know, learning how to... ways to get sounds and record, and he did some things that I thought were weird, like at certain points, like separating the cymbals from the rest of the drums, like having you he had you play some without playing the cymbals and then overdubbing the cymbals, which was kind of interesting. But it's like just learning about and ways to layer things, and I learned a lot about bass from Evan. After our original bass player left, Evan Dando filled in on bass with us for a while. Mm-hmm. And this was before I knew how to play bass. And I think that he was one of my earliest influences as a bass player, just watching him play. And he was very melodic. Bass player played kind of like a guitar player. And now I can't remember the question, but...
Whatever you want to say about Evan, and he's all of our dear friend. He's a genius. That guy's an amazing musician.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's some talent.
It's unbelievable music that's been put out, and you know, I mean, Shame About Ray, which was the record that Juliana you were on.
Yeah,
I mean, you've done a lot of stuff, but
it.
I mean, that really was an album that just crossed over. I mean, yeah. And in a way that I thought did it without MTV. And I know MTV played a big role in all this stuff, and there were videos and all that kind of stuff. But it really felt like that record was just one that anyone who was thirsting for alternative music at the time that maybe wasn't as hard and grungy as what you were getting on the West Coast found that Lemonheads record and just attached to it.
Yeah, it was so good. And Evan was just all about... He was just like a true music lover and a music scholar, and just like he has so much information about bands, and he knows a lot about music.
Yeah.
he's really good at it.
A lot of stuff.
I forget what I was gonna say.
Well, and he just like absorbed his influences in a way like nobody else that I've ever known.
Yeah, and such a great voice. And it wasn't for him, and what he had at a certain point after he signed with Atlantic, he was sort of seen as some kind of pinup by certain people, mm-hmm. like as a dumb blonde pretty boy, which wasn't him at all, and that wasn't his doing, you know, like that he wasn't that at all. He was all about the music, really, and you know, the lifestyle.
like girls. Well, it was a really weird moment there because the Blake Babies broke up, and you know, and Juliana's career immediately took off, and Evan's career immediately took off in an even bigger way. So, you know, there was this strange moment where, you know, we're back in Indiana, and those two are on the covers of magazines and stuff. And it was very generous of Evan to bring me back into the band for a while because I got to experience that. And I think it helps me to do what I do now that I got to experience being in a mm-hmm. huge rock band, you know, which I wouldn't have gotten to do without his generosity.
John Strom, Frieda Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield, Blake Babies. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the limited stuff that you're doing now, the show that you have at Space coming up on Saturday afternoon, and the release of the Earwig demos. Blake Babies in studio. Stay with us.
I've got a girl in a box. Keep her under my bed. Sure must get hot in the summertime. I get her out. There's nothing else to do. There's nothing on TV.
It's so hard to fade down on these songs.
Oh, get rid of that one.
Get rid of that one. John Strom, Frieda Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield in studio, Blake Babies. Celebrating their 30th anniversary, the band that college rock.
On that.
Yeah, isn't? I mean, it's that's sort of the peg.
It is
right?
The anniversary. Yes,
it's the anniversary.
We started 30
Seven.
Years ago
Embrace
today.
It.
A Boston-based college rock band, which is sort of before we call it indie rock, it's college rock. That really, I mean, just an amazing amount of work in such a short amount of time. The band broke up in 1990, 1991, after 4 years together. They're back together in a limited way. This isn't really like a reunion tour. You guys are kind of selectively picking different places to play intimate shows, really on the fact that the demos are being released for Earwig.
Well, that was we talked a little bit about the Pledge campaign earlier, so, and this is something I was trying to see what we could get away with Juliana before she's great uncle, you know. So I was like, we could play a couple shows, right? And So we kind of snuck them into the Pledge package, and the idea behind these shows, which we've been true to, is that they would be a very limited number of shows and very limited attendance, you know, and it's kind of a high ticket price because we wanted to keep it, you know, just real fans who are really excited to be there, and that was definitely the vibe in Boston or Somerville when we played. It was people who were really, really psyched to be there, which made it way more special.
But they get. Extra special things like we're not it yes. makes it that's almost sounds like we're because there's the biggest fans we're going to charge more money
no
that's
I mean
not,
it's,
we included a copy
okay.
of the
we
record.
Gave them more things yeah there's more of an experience with the band
well you guys yeah. are taking a crowdsource approach which I mean every single act that I have on the show seems to be doing this kind of thing where there is this direct one-to-one with your audience now. You don't have to go through labels. You don't have to get radio play. You don't have to get on TV. You can go one-to-one, and Blake Babies seems to be a perfect project for that kind of thing because you do have rabid fans that were interested in that band, interested in what you guys have done since, even here in Chicago. I mean, this is a Blake Babies town.
And we're giving them a lot of value for that. You know, it's like we're charging what we have to charge to make it work financially because, you know, it is a small crowd and we're traveling. And you know, we met everybody personally. We did a Q&A afterwards. You know, we signed every big stacks of stuff people brought. You know, which is strange for me because I work with artists and it's been a long time since I've been on that side of the table. But it was cool because our fans are really cool.
Just wait till some girl asks you to sign her boob.
Oh, it's happened. I was in the Lemonheads, Julian.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left here, and I really want to get, if you guys will indulge me, to be introspective about your careers. I mean, you guys we talk about the 30th anniversary. You know, you started off and you talked about the idea of wanting to be in a band, and that's it. You wanted to that was the idea. There wasn't this ambition to be rock stars in the way that, you know, that was available in 1986. You know, you didn't want to be Paul Abdul. So why don't we start? We go around the table. John, for you, your life, you are an entertainment lawyer in Nashville. You wrote an article which was really interesting about the idea of music now being a hobby.
Right, right.
But talk about that. Talk about where you're at now and the fact that you as a musician, a guy who was in the Blake Babies, Lemonheads, Antenna, these bands down the line now, you know, rarely pick up the guitar.
I pick up the guitar all the time. I've been through periods where I didn't play much. But that article that I wrote, which is thetalkhouse.com, I thought was important because I think not enough people embrace music as a hobby. People feel like they have to be ambitious and have to do something with it and have to be public about it. And, you know, music is joyous. That's why I got into doing it. And one thing I realized, because my entertainment law career is really working with musicians. I really almost exclusively work with artists, helping them with their careers. And I realized that what I enjoy doing is exactly what I enjoyed most about being in the Blake Babies, which was the kind of project aspect of it, you know. We're building something, you know, how do we do this? How do we get a gig? And you know, how do we record? Those sorts of things, which were really challenges that we had to figure out, you know, one thing at a time. And that's very much like what I do now for my clients. So, you know, I'm still doing most of what I loved about that. And then I'm playing all the time, which is what I loved about, you know, playing music, right?
So when you look at, I mean, we talked to the John Strom of Blake Babies back in 1988 and say, when you get older, you'll be an entertainment lawyer.
I mean, I think I would have thought that it was just a total disaster. You know, it's like I'm a suburban dad and I'm a lawyer. What? I'm not that guy, you know, but it's great. I love my life. And so much of what we did and what I learned back then I apply to my life now, which is great.
Frida, all right, for all you right. I mean, we talked a lot about this already with the memoir when you came in,
we did.
Just about the idea of, you know, thinking back now to the days of Blake Babies, you know, now as we've now decided to peg his 30-year anniversary. What role does music play in your life, and more importantly, when you think of those times, you know, talk about what it means to you to have been a part of this band.
So music has moved in and out of my life, but it's one of those things that has always come back. I actually had 8 years where I didn't play at all, but now I'm playing a lot, and it feels great to be able to come at it from where I'm at now in my life. Like I really appreciate it in a way that I think when I look back on those 30 years ago, that maybe I was looking a little bit more like, what can music do for me and what can I get out of this? And I feel opposite of that now. Like it feels so lucky to me to be able to be doing it, especially to be playing with John and Julianne again, to kind of have another chance to play with them. So I feel kind of older, wiser, and more grateful. And also, I think I thought, like, when I was older, I wouldn't be playing music. I think I drew stricter categories on different phases of my life when I was younger. And now I just feel kind of open-minded to be surprised by it and to just see where it takes me.
Julianne Hatfield. You've had a life in which you've been a musician. I mean, you have gone further in ambition. You've been a pop star. You continue to tour. You continue to create new works and continue to be a working touring musician. Talk about that time, what it means to you, the Blake Babies, and also about what music means to you.
The Blake Babies was really, such a cherished and important time in my life. It was my first real band, and it was the start of everything for me. You know, it was the start of a lot of my dreams eventually coming true. And it was, that was the beginning of it. You know, when I first met John and Frida and we went and we jammed in their apartment on that first night when we first met, I felt like my dream is literally coming true. And then, you know, other of my dreams came true after that, you know, like having a song on the radio, here, going into a new city on tour and hearing, turning on the radio in the car and hearing my song. And it was just like, this is my dream come true, meeting a bunch of my heroes. And but I also feel kind of, I feel this bittersweetness when I think about it all, because I'm still frustrated, and I feel like, I don't know, I feel I'm allowing myself finally at this period of my life to, you know, think about, I've always been very stoic about everything, but now I'm allowing myself to think, like, why did, you know, this, that one period a long time ago get so much attention and nothing else that I've done since then? Mm-hmm. And because I've never stopped making music. And it's strange to think that this period of a few years of my life was the period that got so much attention. And then I guess that's just what happens, though. You know, like, that happens to everybody.
Not Neil Young.
Yeah. Neil Young. Not when you're young.
But
right?
I mean, there's one something is sort of more beloved than, I don't really know what I'm trying to say.
I think I make sense. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not trying to get us all down in the room.
But it's
30
down.
Years. And it's, as a fan of your music, and I speak for everybody who's a fan of your music, I mean, it is great that it's lasting, and you can hear the songs that we just played, or you can go on even the streaming services and put Blake Babies in, and here come all the songs and the stuff rushing back to you. And that's a testament to what you guys have accomplished. John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield. They're playing at Space in Evanston. Tickets will be available at that show.
Yeah, you can get the full package through Pledge, and for a somewhat lower ticket price, I think it's $50, you can go just
to the door
for the show.
It's daytime, so it's Saturday at 1.
It's 1 o'clock doors. Open, yeah. We play promptly at 1:30. It'll all be over by 3:30. There's going to be we're going to play a long set Q&A and try to meet everybody, and it's going to be good fun.
And the demo, the Earwig demo, is a part of the Pledge Now campaign. You can find that if you go to Pledge Music.
PledgeMusic.com. You can find it easily. Eventually they'll be widely distributed, but for now that's the only place you can get it.
Can I say one more thing? Mm-hmm. I feel like I just brought everything down.
No.
What I really want to end with is I'm so extremely proud of the work that we did as the Blake Babies. I'm so proud of all of it.
All right. There
Amen.
You go.
Nice.
Juliana, John, Frida, thanks for being here. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you
so
much.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Tonight, the Republican National Convention finishes up. Day 4. So excited to have back in studio with me Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson. Professor Charles Lipson, political science professor at the University of Chicago. Chris Roebling, the better half of Touche, which you can hear every Monday night here on the Download. Good to see you guys. Last night, I've been saying it all day. I told my bosses, I told everyone. I'm like, I had a great time watching you guys. It was almost electric the way that you responded to the Ted Cruz speech.
Hey, it was a lot of fun, huh?
Yeah.
Well, how a batter stands at the plate and thinks the ball is coming straight in, and then all of a sudden it's a sinker that slides to the outside, and you think, how could he possibly have swung at that? During the first part of the speech, it just was red meat, Republican. It was all about liberty. And then, all of a sudden, he froze in place. His bat stayed on his shoulder. He was absolutely unwilling to swing.
You know, for us, I mean, one of the things we ended with last night is, what did we think the blowback would be today? We were met this morning with Senator Cruz almost doubling down. He wasn't apologetic. He talked about, he actually came out and said, yeah, it was essentially
and
revenge.
He gave a personal
yeah,
that's exactly right.
Right.
I mean, he didn't say, look, I'm a principled conservative. I believe in X, Y, and Z, and I can only endorse that. He didn't say that. He said, this man insulted my wife. This man insulted my father. I'm not. And that calls off my pledge.
And I just thought that was kind of interesting in the way that I thought he would go the route of being a little bit more political, in the sense that it felt like, you know, this would be an opportunity for him to set himself for a political run in 2020. But instead, he did get personal. It was just personal.
You know, he should have stood up in front of that crowd and said, look, I know there are a lot of people out there who are never Trump, and nobody has more reason to be never Trump than me. But I know what Hillary is all about. Mm-hmm. I am going to vote for Trump. I'm going to ask everybody who voted for me to vote for Trump. And I'm going to find other people to vote for Trump. Now, if he had said that at the back end of this speech that Charles describes, which Charles uses the word red meat, and I don't think he's excluding the category.
You're not
I'm
a vegetarian,
about
to, are
I
you?
I am not a vegetarian, okay. But I do want to say that Stalin used to say anyone who hesitates on terror is a vegetable. But I want to say specifically that was a thoughtful speech. And I think that a lot of people in that hall heard a successor to Ronald Reagan. And I think there is a longing for that, and there will be a longing for that. I don't think that Donald Trump is going to eradicate memories of Ronald Reagan, okay? And I think that Cruz went from successor to has-been in one speech.
In one speech.
He would have shot himself in the foot if he hadn't hit something further up.
Chris Rowling, Charles Lipson in studio. We are getting ready. We're thinking that Donald Trump is going to speak sometime after the 9 o'clock hour. As we get ready, we're going to preview the speech and talk about this Republican National Convention overall. Just kind of recap what has been a strange convention, one that at the beginning of the week, if I remember this correctly, Chris Rowling said it can't be like Tampa. Has this been like Tampa?
Yeah, I think you added to this conversation last night on the program. The program had Randy Haltgren, mm-hmm. and I asked Randy, are we getting what we need as Republicans from this? He said, well, not really. Maybe tomorrow night.
I was watching Chris hit his forehead with his hand as he was listening.
Well, in a way, I mean, it was interesting that Congressman Haltgren, who really could have said, well, you know, this was a blip in the road. We're all unified behind one message. And he didn't. Instead, he kind of said, well, you know what? I don't know where we're at. I don't know what to expect. And this isn't going the way I think it should go.
Yeah, now, normally the coach, the losing end on a 0-46 says, well, you know, the defensive backfield looks so much better than they had. He didn't even say that. He just said, there is a divided convention. And I think in a lot of ways, it's very much like Trump himself has divided the country in unusual ways. I think the convention is divided in unusual ways. It looks as if a lot of the social conservatives have come round. A lot of the fiscal conservatives have come round, even though Trump is really not one of them.
Yeah.
They were reassured, to be sure, by the Pence choice. But there are still a lot of Winnetka Republicans that haven't come round. Wouldn't you say? I mean, you
right.
There's a reason that Mark Kirk isn't going there. There's a reason that represented Wilmette and so forth, you wouldn't go.
Well, I think there are folks who find him to be just personally repugnant.
Mm-hmm.
And they find, and it's not just an affect, it's behavior. It's behavior. It's making fun of a reporter who has MS. All of these invocations of images that can be interpreted as leading towards racism or bigotry. And it's this question of where he stands relative to the very seriously thought out conservative worldview, which is represented theoretically by the Republican Party. And so I think those people are not convinced. The only thing they're convinced of is that Trump will do a better job nominating Supreme Court justices than Hillary Clinton. Apart from that, it's Katie bar the door.
Okay, Charles Lipson, Chris Roebling, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll preview tonight's Donald Trump speech. The speech already leaked, quote unquote, to the media. We'll talk about what we know, what we've read, and sort of give you an idea of what to expect from Donald Trump as we cover the final day hours here of the Republican National Convention. Just for a weather update, a thunderstorm warning has been issued for DuPage and Cook County. That's going to be ending at 9:30. So a National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for both DuPage and Cook County coming up here until 9:30. Stay with us. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at the top of the hour, Rob Martier will come back with some local news. A Chicago police officer shot in the line of duty tonight. His condition is stabilized at Northwestern, but Rob will have that story in 12 minutes at the top of the hour. Right now we're talking about the Republican National Convention. Donald Trump expected to speak within the next half hour. Charles Lipson, Chris Roebling in studio with me. Let's get right to it. Let's talk about the speech. What do we expect? Now, Chris, you've read the speech. You got the speech in advance.
Yeah.
Because you're part of the inner circle.
Not really. But I did see it. You know, I think that it's – I think it's good. I think it's – I'm not sure it's not nearly as eloquent as, say, what we heard last night from Cruz or even as I would say profound as what Gingrich was saying and parts that I heard of Gingrich. But it's an interesting speech, and it is going to identify it seeks to identify Trump with average Americans and to identify Trump with average Americans of every background, of every neighborhood, of every circumstance in society. And he takes on this thing of I am going to be your voice or I am your voice. I think there is a fair amount of Hillary, you know, comparison, right? There is some, we all thought there would be, I thought there was going to be a little bit of Hillary. Hopefully there were going to be a few substantive policy points. I'll get back to that. And then there was going to be something stirring about the speech.
Charles, you have not read the speech. What, you know, because it kind of the
that
preview
won't
of the speech.
That won't prevent me from talking at length need, about
what,
it.
What does he need to do tonight as the nominee for the Republican Party? What does Donald Trump need to do on that stage?
He needs to clarify what main issues he's going to run on beyond immigration and a kind of make America better, which is vague, but no vaguer than hope and change.
Sure.
This is a change election. And in that sense, it ought to be his to lose. The problem is he scares a lot of people. So one question is whether he's going to be able to reassure people. One question the inner the sort of journalists are going to be looking at, they've seen the speech, even if it's embargoed. Does he go off script? Does he stop the teleprompter, which would be a planned off script thing? And I'm virtually certain he'll do that.
I mean, but what do we expect? I'm fascinated by this because Donald Trump is in all cases that we've seen him in his rallies and on the in the debates and other places he's on public, he's an off the cuff kind of guy. He almost speaks with this authority in this way that almost feels like he's saying what he means and means what he says. Is Donald Trump does he have to keep that style and read a scripted script? You know, how do you do that if you're Donald Trump?
He can't look as if he's under the control of his handlers. But in fact, I don't think that'll be hard for him to do because I don't think there is anybody who can handle him.
Chris, what do you think?
I think Donald Trump understands that this is the big time, that this speech has got to reach out to people who still don't know much about him. This has still been a sort of parochial activity. The caucuses, the primaries, the Republican Party. You know, you go into some state like Pennsylvania, the Republican Party is, the activist Republicans are 1/85th of the entire state. So now he is reaching a national audience, and indeed, of course, an international audience. But the national audience, he must take advantage of this platform.
And he does have one advantage, that almost all politicians are mediated through journalists. I've seen cases where CNN, I'm not talking about Fox, will cut away from an actual Hillary Clinton speech to look at an empty podium awaiting Donald Trump. So he's got recurrent and will continue to have an ability to speak directly to the American people. But just like your question poses, he has to seize that opportunity.
Well, I just wonder, I mean, as a stylized, the way he's been able to speak is that he isn't a politician. He isn't a statesman who gets up on stage and delivers these this rhetoric that is, we know that's management speak.
But let me ask Chris a question.
How does he do that?
Let me ask Chris a question. What's the downside of not being a politician? We know what the upside is. Okay. What's the downside?
I mean, there are a variety of downsides, and we've seen them here in Illinois with Bruce Rauner, who is, I think, a faithful guy, and he's trying to do his best. But I think that there is something to the public life. That is a life that is distinct from, right, regular people walking around on the street. So you stand in the public spotlight, and people have certain expectations of you. And if you meet those, Harold Washington is just a spectacular example, a guy who understood this just like he would wake up in the morning. That's how visceral and how inherently political Harold Washington was. And I think that Trump is somewhat like that, but you can also sell short the significance of that public life and the significance of the mores and the practices and the usages of that public life.
That's right. Politicians, when they run the second time, don't make nearly as many unforced errors. But I think that there's been a missed opportunity for the Republicans at the convention. And as I said last night, I'm not speaking as I generally vote Republican, but I'm not a sort of party line kind of person, and I don't agree with Republicans on some issues. But I think that what they wanted to get through were two or three big issues. And in particular, we can make you safer, we can make your future more prosperous, and we can return governance away from Washington and back toward more localities.
Absolutely.
Those themes did not come through this convention.
Isn't that the same message at Bernie Sanders on the Democrat side?
Well, you're going to hear a lot from Trump tonight about law and order. And you're going to hear a lot from Trump tonight about cops being shot. You're going to hear a lot from Trump tonight about reestablishing, you know, respect for our, you know, way of life. And that is a very big part of the speech. And I want to go back to that asterisk that I left over. What do you get? Trump has been so vague about the specific value proposition of voting for Trump that tonight is the night for him to give regular people, the 60 million people who might be watching, boy, if I vote for Trump, I am going to get X and Y and Z.
You're a communications guy. If I ask you in advance, Chris Robley, what's the right mix of Trump talking about what he and Pence can do versus attacking Hillary? Should it be 70-30? Should it be 80-20? And then what really is it in the speech?
Well, I think it should be, frankly, I think the attack on Hillary should be carried out at the convention, should be carried out by others. I think that Hillary bashing in Trump's speech should be less than 20%.
And is it?
No, I think it's probably more like 33 1/3. And I think that it is. I think the part for Trump to give some sort of, he has to explain himself. He has to introduce himself to people. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part. He has to talk about what you're going to get with him. And then he's got to give something inspirational at the end. And I think that would be the other 80%, probably split 60-20.
Can I ask a question just about politics? I mean, Donald Trump, when he ran in the primary, was the furthest thing possible from the law and order candidate. This was not an issue that he was sort of, I mean, he ran on immigration. He ran on winning. He ran on business negotiations, a deal. Is it politics that he has taken this and he's going to lead with this, that Make America Safe Again, Law and Order candidate, because he sees an opportunity to be
Let me say two or three things about it. The first thing is the immigration issue was at least half a Law and Order issue. Yeah. I think for a lot of people, it's not a cultural issue. It's that it's sovereignty and it's about law and you shouldn't skip to the head of the line. Secondly, Law and Order is a traditional Republican issue, and it's counterposed to other issues on the Democratic side. And the third thing is, I think Trump is a guy who sees his chances and he grabs them.
Is he comfortable in that role? I mean, can he be that guy? He never seemed to be sort of a, and I'm not saying he wasn't pro Law and Order. It just didn't seem like it was something that he was strong, like that sort of that principle, that that Republican principle.
Remember,
that you just
though,
mentioned. Is he going to?
Everybody in New York got rich when Rudy Giuliani cleaned up the utter mess that was that city. So it's not as if he hasn't seen up close and personal what a well-run city can do for everybody in it.
I think Trump is vitally interested in law and order. I mean, he is a property guy. He's a real estate guy. And I agree with Charles that the whole entree into immigration, or you could even say the birther thing, which was goofy, but
it was goofy.
The entree into immigration was all about law and order. And I think there is a weakness. I think there's, it's not the same weakness as in 1968, because in 1968, you had a lot of post-war sociology and social psychology that was questioning the role of the state in adjudicating petty crime or not so petty crime. And so you had this permissiveness that was parading under the Democratic cloak.
Right.
And that led to permissive judges.
And Hillary's got a really tough position here because she absolutely has to capture all the black vote. And talking about law and order is often perceived as an attack on the black community. Trump himself has to avoid that.
Charles Lipson, Chris Roebling. We're going to get to the speech, which should be coming up in the next 10-15 minutes. We're covering the Republican National Convention. Tonight, Donald Trump speaks. Stay with us.
And as we take a look up at the monitor right now in Cleveland, Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's daughter, is taking to the stage to introduce her father.
In his own way and through his own sheer force of will, he sacrificed greatly to enter the political arena as an outsider. And he prevailed against a field of 16 very talented competitors. For more than a year, Donald Trump has been the people's champion. And tonight, he is the people's nominee. Like many of my fellow millennials, I do not consider myself categorically Republican or Democrat. More than party affiliation, I vote based on what I believe is right for my family and for my country. Sometimes it's a tough choice. That is not the case this time. As the proud daughter of your nominee, I am here to tell you that this is the moment and Donald Trump is the person to make America great again. Real change, the kind we have not seen in decades, is only going to come from outside the system. And it's only going to come from a man who has spent his entire life doing what others said could not be done. My father is a fighter. When the primaries got tough, and they were tough, he did what any great leader does. He dug deeper, worked harder, got better, and became stronger. I have seen him fight for his family. I have seen him fight for his employees. I have seen him fight for his company. And now I am seeing him fight for our country. It's been the story of his life, and more recently, the spirit of his campaign. It's also a prelude to reaching the goal that unites us all, when this party, and better still, this country, knows what it is like to win again. If it's possible to be famous and yet not really well known, that describes the father who raised me. In the same office in Trump Tower where we now work together, I remember playing on the floor by my father's desk, constructing miniature buildings with Legos and erector sets, while he did the same with concrete, steel, and glass. My father taught my siblings and me the importance of positive values and a strong ethical compass. He showed us how to be resilient, how to deal with challenges, and how to strive for excellence in all that we do. He taught us that there is nothing we cannot accomplish if we marry vision and passion with an enduring work ethic. One of my father's greatest talents is his ability to see potential in people before they see it in themselves. It was like that for us too growing up. He taught us that potential vanishes into nothing without effort, and that like him, we each had a responsibility to work not just for ourselves, but for the betterment of the world around us. Over the years, on too many occasions to count, I saw my father tear stories out of the newspaper about people whom he had never met who were facing some injustice or hardship. He'd write a note to his assistant in a signature black felt-tip pen and request that the person be found and invited to Trump Tower to meet with him. He would talk to them and then draw upon his extensive network to find them a job or get them a break. And they would leave his office, as people so often do after having been with Donald Trump, feeling that life could be great again. Throughout my entire life, I have witnessed his empathy and generosity towards others, especially those who are suffering. It is just his way of being in your corner when you're down. My father not only has the strength and ability necessary to be our next president, but also the kindness and compassion that will enable him to be the leader that this country needs. My father has a sense of fairness that touches every conviction he's held. I've worked alongside of him for more than a decade now at the Trump Organization, and I've seen how he operates as a leader, making important decisions that shape careers and that change lives. I've learned a lot about the world from walking construction jobs by his side. When run properly, construction sites are true meritocracies. Competence in the building trades is easy to spot, and incompetence is impossible to hide. These sites are also incredible melting pots, gathering people from all walks of life and uniting them to work towards a single mission. There have always been men of all background and ethnicities on my father's job sites, and long before it was commonplace, you also saw women. My father values talent. He recognizes real knowledge and skill when he finds it. He is colorblind and gender neutral. He hires the best person for the job, period. Words and promises, no matter how visionary they sound, will only get you so far. In our business, you're not a builder unless you've got a building to show for it. Or in my father's case, city skylines. Most people strive their entire lives to achieve great success in a single industry. My father has succeeded in many, on the highest level and on a global scale. One of the reasons he has thrived as an entrepreneur is because he listens to everyone. Billionaire executives don't usually ask the people doing the work for their opinion of the work. My father is an exception. On every one of his projects, you'll see him talking to the super, the painter, the engineers, the electricians. He'll ask them for their feedback, if they think something should be done differently or could be done better. When Donald Trump is in charge, all that counts is ability, effort, and excellence. This has long been the philosophy at the Trump Organization. At my father's company, there are more female than male executives. Women are paid equally for the work that we do, and when a woman becomes a mother, she is supported, not shut out. Women represent 46% of the total U.S. labor force, and 40% of American households have female primary breadwinners. In 2014, women made 83 cents for every dollar earned by a man. Single women without children earned 94 cents for each dollar earned by a man, whereas married mothers made only 77 cents. As researchers have noted, gender is no longer the factor creating the greatest wage discrepancy in this country. Motherhood is. As president, my father will change the labor laws that were put in place at a time when women were not a significant portion of the workforce. And he will focus on making quality childcare affordable and accessible for all. As a mother myself of three young children, I know how hard it is to work while raising a family. And I also know that I'm far more fortunate than most. American families need relief. Policies that allow women with children to thrive should not be novelties. They should be the norm. Politicians talk about wage equality, but my father has made it a practice at his company throughout his entire career. He will fight for equal pay, for equal work, and I will fight for this too, right alongside of him. Americans today need an economy that permits people to rise again. A Trump presidency will turn the economy around and restore the great American tradition of giving each new generation hope for brighter opportunities than those of the generation that came before. In Donald Trump, you have a candidate who knows the difference between wanting something done and making it happen. When my father says that he will build a tower, keep an eye on the skyline. Floor by floor, a soaring structure will appear, usually record-setting in its height and iconic in its design. Real people are hired to do real work. Vision becomes reality. When my father says that he will make America great again, he will deliver. We have a chance this year to reclaim our heritage as a country that dreams big and makes the impossible happen. Fortunately, Donald Trump is incapable of thinking small. When I was a child, my father always told me, Ivanka, if you're going to be thinking anyway, you might as well think big. As president, my father will take on the bold and worthy fights. He will be unafraid to set lofty goals, and he will be relentless in his determination to achieve them. To people all over America, I say, when you have my father in your corner, you will never again have to worry about being let down. He will fight for you all the time, all the way, every time. Maybe it's the developer in him, but Donald Trump cannot stand to see empty main streets and boarded up factories. He can't bear the injustice of college graduates who are crippled by student debt and mothers who can't afford the cost of the childcare required to return to work to better the lives of their families. Other politicians see these hardships, see the unfairness of it all, and they say, I feel for you. Only my father will say, I'll fight for you. The hardworking men and women of this country identify with my father. He is tough and he is persevering. He is honest and he is real. He's an optimist and he's a relentless believer in America and all of her potential. He loves his family and he loves his country with his heart and his soul. Politicians ask to be judged by their promises, not their results. I ask you to judge my father by his results. Judge his values by those he's instilled in his children. Judge his competency by the towers he's built, the companies he's founded, and the tens of thousands of jobs he's created. He is the single most qualified person to serve as chief executive of an $18 trillion economy. My father will call upon the best and brightest people from all spheres of industry and both sides of the aisle, a new set of thinkers to face our country's existing and future problems with fresh perspective and brave new solutions. Come January 17, all things will be possible again. We can hope and dream and think big again. No one has more faith in the American people than my father. He will be your greatest, your truest, and your most loyal champion. This is the fighter, the doer, that you have chosen as your nominee. In ways no one expected, this moment in the life of our country has defined a mission and given it to an extraordinary man. He is ready to see it all the way through, to speak to every man and every woman of every background in every part of this great country, to earn your trust and to earn your vote. He earned that and much more from me a long time ago. I have loved and respected him my entire life, and I could not be more proud tonight to present to you and to all of America my father and our next president, Donald J. Trump.
There we go. As she introduces Donald Trump, he walks to the stage. He's going to do his
wave.
So really quick, what do we think?
I think Ivanka Trump continues to humanize Donald Trump. It's another success on the kid side. And she also had some substance there about the plight of women and working women.
And millennials. I think that the Trump children showed how the whole family is actually in touch with ordinary people. A total success, I would say.
Okay, so that's the introduction. Now Donald Trump accepts the nomination and gives a speech here. We're going to keep it live here on 720 WGN Radio. He's walking up to the stage. Got to let everybody do the standing ovation. Strong start, guys. I mean, so...
I think this is the moment that we never thought would actually come. I mean, it's a moment that 14, 15 months ago, people would have said, oh, you're crazy. He is not going to win this nomination. Here he is tonight accepting the nomination.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Friends, delegates, and fellow Americans, I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States. USA, 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 USA. Who would have believed that when we started this journey on June 16th, last year, we, and I say we, because we are a team, would have received almost 14 million votes, the most in the history of the Republican Party, and that the Republican Party would get 60% more votes than it received 8 years ago. Who would have believed this? Who would have believed this? The Democrats, on the other hand, received 20% fewer votes than they got 4 years ago. Not so good, not so good. Together, we will lead our party back to the White House, and we will lead our country back to safety, prosperity, and peace. We will be a country of generosity and warmth, but we will also be a country of law and order. Our convention occurs at a moment of crisis for our nation. The attacks on our police and the terrorism of our cities threaten our very way of life. Any politician who does not grasp this danger is not fit to lead our country. Americans watching this address tonight have seen the recent images of violence in our streets and the chaos in our communities. Many have witnessed this violence personally. Some have even been its victims. I have a message for all of you. The crime and violence that today afflicts our nation will soon, and I mean very soon, come to an end. Beginning on January 20th of 2017, safety will be restored. The most basic duty of government is to defend the lives of its own citizens. Any government that fails to do so is a government unworthy to lead. It is finally time for a straightforward assessment of the state of our nation. I will present the facts plainly and honestly. We cannot afford to be so politically correct anymore. So if you want to hear the corporate spin, the carefully crafted lies, and the media myths, the Democrats are holding their convention next week. Go there. But here at our convention, there will be no lies. We will honor the American people with the truth and nothing else.
These are the facts. Decades of progress made in bringing down crime are now being reversed by this administration's rollback of criminal enforcement. Homicides last year increased by 17% in America's 50 largest cities. That's the largest increase in 25 years. In our nation's capital, killings have risen by 50%. They're up nearly 60% in nearby Baltimore. In the president's hometown of Chicago, more than 2,000 people have been the victim of shootings this year alone, and almost 4,000 have been killed in the Chicago area since he took office. The number of police officers killed in the line of duty has risen by almost 50% compared to this point last year. Nearly 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records ordered deported from our country are tonight roaming free to threaten peaceful citizens. The number of new illegal immigrant families who have crossed the border so far this year already exceeds the entire total from 2015. They are being released by the tens of thousands into our communities with no regard for the impact on public safety or resources. One such border crosser was released and made his way to Nebraska. There, he ended the life of an innocent young girl named Sarah Root. She was 21 years old and was killed the day after graduating from college with a 4.0 grade point average, number one in her class. Her killer was then released a second time, and he is now a fugitive from the law. I've met Sarah's beautiful family, but to this administration, their amazing daughter was just one more American life that wasn't worth protecting. No more. One more child to sacrifice on the order and on the altar of open borders. What about our economy? Again, I will tell you the plain facts that have been edited out of your nightly news and your morning newspaper. Nearly 4 in 10 African American children are living in poverty, while 58% of African American youth are now not employed. 2 million more Latinos are in poverty today than when President Obama took his oath of office less than 8 years ago. Another 14 million people have left the workforce entirely. Household incomes are down more than $4,000 since the year 2000. That's 16 years ago. Our trade deficit in goods reached nearly, think of this, our trade deficit is $800 billion, think of that, $800 billion last year alone. We're going to fix that. The budget is no better. President Obama has almost doubled our national debt to more than $19 trillion and growing. And yet, what do we have to show for it? Our roads and bridges are falling apart. Our airports are third world condition. And 43 million Americans are in food stamps. Now, let us consider the state of affairs abroad. Not only have our citizens endured domestic disaster, but they've lived through one international humiliation after another, one after another. We all remember the images of our sailors being forced to their knees by their Iranian captors at gunpoint. This was just prior to the signing of the Iran deal, which gave back to Iran $150 billion and gave us absolutely nothing. It will go down in history as one of the worst deals ever negotiated. Another humiliation came when President Obama drew a red line in Syria, and the whole world knew it meant absolutely nothing. In Libya, our consulate, the symbol of American prestige around the globe, was brought down in flames. America is far less safe, and the world is far less stable than when Obama made the decision to put Hillary Clinton in charge of America's foreign policy. Let's defeat her in November. Okay. I am certain that it was a decision that President Obama truly regrets. Her bad instincts and her bad judgment, something pointed out by Bernie Sanders, are what caused so many of the disasters unfolding today. Let's review the record. In 2009, pre-Hillary, ISIS was not even on the map. Libya was stable. Egypt was peaceful. Iraq was seeing and really a big, big reduction in violence. Iran was being choked by sanctions. Syria was somewhat under control. After 4 years of Hillary Clinton, what do we have? ISIS has spread across the region and the entire world. Libya is in ruins, and our ambassador and his staff were left helpless to die at the hands of savage killers. Egypt was turned over to the radical Muslim Brotherhood, forcing the military to retake control. Iraq is in chaos. Iran is on the path to nuclear weapons. Syria is engulfed in a civil war, and a refugee crisis now threatens the West. After 15 years of wars in the Middle East, after trillions of dollars spent and thousands of lives lost, the situation is worse than it has ever been before. This is the legacy of Hillary Clinton. Death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness. But Hillary Clinton's legacy does not have to be America's legacy. The problems we face now, poverty and violence at home, war and destruction abroad, will last only as long as we continue relying on the same politicians who created them in the first place. A change in leadership is required to produce a change in outcomes. Tonight, I will share with you my plan for action for America. The most important difference between our plan and that of our opponent is that our plan will put America first. Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo as long as we are led by politicians who will not put America first. Then we can be assured that other nations will not treat America with respect, the respect that we deserve. The American people will come first once again. My plan will begin with safety at home, which means safe neighborhoods, secure borders, and protection from terrorism. There can be no prosperity without law and order. On the economy, I will outline reforms to add millions of new jobs and trillions in new wealth that can be used to rebuild America. A number of these reforms that I will outline tonight will be opposed by some of our nation's most powerful special interests. That's because these interests have rigged our political and economic system for their exclusive benefit. Believe me, it's for their benefit. Big business, elite media, and major donors are lining up behind the campaign of my opponent because they know she will keep our rigged system in place. They are throwing money at her because they have total control over every single thing she does. She is their puppet, and they pull the strings. That is why Hillary Clinton's message is that things will never change, never ever. My message is that things have to change, and they have to change right now. Every day, I wake up determined to deliver a better life for the people all across this nation that have been ignored, neglected, and abandoned. I have visited the laid-off factory workers and the communities crushed by our horrible and unfair trade deals. These are the forgotten men and women of our country, and they are forgotten, but they're not going to be forgotten long. These are people who work hard, but no longer have a voice. I am your voice. I have embraced crying mothers who have lost their children because our politicians put their personal agendas before the national good. I have no patience for injustice.
You are listening to Donald Trump speak at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
And how great is Cleveland? Thank you. I have no patience for injustice, no tolerance for government incompetence, of which there is so much, no sympathy for leaders who fail their citizens. When innocent people suffer because our political system lacks the will or the courage or the basic decency to enforce our laws, or still worse, has sold out to some corporate lobbyist for cash, I am not able to look the other way, and I won't look the other way. And when a Secretary of State illegally stores her emails on a private server, deletes 33,000 of them so the authorities can't see her crime, puts our country at risk, lies about it in every different form, and faces no consequence, I know that corruption has reached a level like never, ever before in our country. When the FBI director says that the Secretary of State was extremely careless and negligent in handling our classified secrets, I also know that these terms are minor compared to what she actually did. They were just used to save her from facing justice for her terrible, terrible crimes. In fact, her single greatest accomplishment may be committing such egregious crime and getting away with it, especially when others who have done far less have paid so dearly. When that same Secretary of State rakes in millions and millions of dollars trading access and favors to special interests and foreign powers, I know the time for action has come. I have joined the political arena so that the powerful can no longer beat up on people who cannot defend themselves. Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it. I have seen firsthand how the system is rigged against our citizens, just like it was rigged against Bernie Sanders. He never had a chance, never had a chance. His supporters will join our movement because we will fix his biggest single issue, trade deals that strip our country of its jobs and strip us of our wealth as a country. Millions of Democrats will join our movement because we are going to fix the system so it works fairly and justly for each and every American. In this cause, I am proud to have at my side the next Vice President of the United States, Governor Mike Pence of Indiana. And a great guy. We will bring the same economic success to America that Mike brought to Indiana, which is amazing. He's a man of character and accomplishment. He is the man for the job. The first task for our new administration will be to liberate our citizens from the crime and terrorism and lawlessness that threatens our communities. America was shocked to its core when our police officers in Dallas were so brutally executed. Immediately after Dallas, we've seen continued threats and violence against our law enforcement officials. Law officers have been shot or killed in recent days in Georgia, Missouri, Wisconsin, Kansas, Michigan, and Tennessee. On Sunday, more police were gunned down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Three were killed, and three were very, very badly injured. An attack on law enforcement is an attack on all Americans. I have a message to every last person threatening the peace on our streets and the safety of our police. When I take the oath of office next year, I will restore law and order to our country. Believe me, believe me. I will work with and appoint the best and brightest prosecutors and law enforcement officials to get the job properly done. In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate. The irresponsible rhetoric of our president, who has used the pulpit of the presidency to divide us by race and color, has made America a more dangerous environment than, frankly, I have ever seen and anybody in this room has ever watched or seen. This administration has failed America's inner cities. Remember, it has failed America's inner cities. It's failed them on education. It's failed them on jobs. It's failed them in crime. It's failed them in every way and on every single level. When I am president, I will work to ensure that all of our kids are treated equally and protected equally. Every action I take, I will ask myself, does this make better for young Americans in Baltimore, in Chicago, in Detroit, in Ferguson, who have really, in every way, folks, the same right to live out their dreams as any other child in America? Any other child. To make life safe for all of our citizens, we must also address the growing threats we face from outside the country. We are going to defeat the barbarians of ISIS, and we're going to defeat them fast. Once again, France is the victim of brutal Islamic terrorism. Men, women, and children viciously mowed down, lives ruined, families ripped apart, a nation in mourning. The damage and devastation that can be inflicted by Islamic radicals has been proven over and over at the World Trade Center, at an office party in San Bernardino, at the Boston Marathon, at a military recruiting center in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and many, many other locations. Only weeks ago, in Orlando, Florida, 49 wonderful Americans were savagely murdered by an Islamic terrorist. This time, the terrorist targeted LGBTQ community. No good. And we're going to stop it. As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me. And I have to say, as a Republican, it is so nice to hear you cheering for what I just said. Thank you. To protect us from terrorism, we need to focus on three things. We must have the best, absolutely the best gathering of intelligence anywhere in the world. The best. We must abandon the failed policy of nation building and regime change that Hillary Clinton pushed in Iraq, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Syria. Instead, we must work with all of our allies who share our goal of destroying ISIS and stamping out Islamic terrorism and doing it now, doing it quickly. We're going to win. We're going to win fast. This includes working with our greatest ally in the region, the State of Israel. Recently, I have said that NATO was obsolete because it did not properly cover terror, and also that many of the member countries were not paying their fair share. As usual, the United States has been picking up the cost. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that NATO will be setting up a new program in order to combat terrorism, a true step in the right direction. Lastly, and very importantly, we must immediately suspend immigration from any nation that has been compromised by terrorism until such time as proven vetting mechanisms have been put in place. We don't want them in our country. My opponent has called for a radical 550% increase in Syrian. Think of this. Think of this. This is not believable, but this is what's happening. A 550% increase in Syrian refugees on top of the existing massive refugee flows coming into our country already under the leadership of President Obama. She proposes this despite the fact that there is no way to screen these refugees in order to find out who they are or where they come from. I only want to admit individuals into our country who will support our values and love our people. Anyone who endorses violence, hatred, or oppression is not welcome in our country and never, ever will be. Decades of record immigration have produced lower wages and higher unemployment for our citizens, especially for African American and Latino workers. We are going to have an immigration system that works, but one that works for the American people. On Monday, we heard from three parents whose children were killed by illegal immigrants. Marianne Mendoza, Sabine Dirt, and my friend, Jameel Shaw. They're just three brave representatives of many thousands who have suffered so gravely. Of all my travels in this country, nothing has affected me more, nothing even close, I have to tell you, than the time I have spent with the mothers and fathers who have lost their children to violence spilling across our borders, which we can solve. We have to solve it. These families have no special interest to represent them. There are no demonstrators to protect them, and certainly none to protest on their behalf. My opponent will never meet with them or share in their pain, believe me. Instead, my opponent wants sanctuary cities. But where was the sanctuary for Kate Steinle? Where was the sanctuary for the children of Marianne and Sabine and Jameel? Where was the sanctuary for all of the other? Oh, it's so sad to even be talking about it because we can solve this problem so quickly. Where was the sanctuary for all of the other Americans who have been so brutally murdered and who have suffered so, so horribly? These wounded American families have been alone, but they are not alone any longer. Tonight, this candidate and the whole nation stand in their corner to support them, to send them our love, and to pledge in their honor that we will save countless more families from suffering and the same awful fate. We are going to build a great border wall to stop illegal immigration, to stop the gangs and the violence, and to stop the drugs from pouring into our communities. I have been honored to receive the endorsement of America's Border Patrol agents. And will work directly with them to protect the integrity of our lawful immigration system. Lawful. By ending catch and release on the border, we will end the cycle of human smuggling and violence. Illegal border crossings will go down. We will stop it. It won't be happening very much anymore, believe me. Peace will be restored by enforcing the rules for millions who overstay their visas. Our laws will finally receive the respect that they deserve. Tonight, I want every American whose demands for immigration security have been denied, and every politician who has denied them, to listen very, very closely to the words I am about to say. On January 20th of 2017, the day I take the oath of office, Americans will finally wake up in a country where the laws of the United States are enforced. We are going to be considerate and compassionate to everyone. But my greatest compassion will be for our own struggling citizens. USA, USA, USA. My plan is the exact opposite of the radical and dangerous immigration policy of Hillary Clinton. Americans want relief from uncontrolled immigration, which is what we have now. Communities want relief, yet Hillary Clinton is proposing mass amnesty, mass immigration, and mass lawlessness. Her plan will overwhelm your schools and hospitals, further reduce your jobs and wages, and make it harder for recent immigrants to escape the tremendous cycle of poverty that they're going through right now and make it almost impossible for them to join the middle class. I have a different vision for our workers. It begins with a new fair trade policy that protects our jobs and stands up to countries that cheat, of which there are many. It's been a signature message of my campaign from day one, and it will be a signature feature of my presidency from the moment I take the oath of office. I have made billions of dollars in business-making deals. Now I'm going to make our country rich again. Using the greatest business people in the world, which our country has, I am going to turn our bad trade agreements into great trade agreements. America has lost nearly one-third of its manufacturing jobs since 1997, following the enactment of disastrous trade deals supported by Bill and Hillary Clinton. Remember, it was Bill Clinton who signed NAFTA, one of the worst economic deals ever made by our country or, frankly, any other country. Never, ever again. I am going to bring back our jobs to Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York and Michigan and all of America. And I am not going to let companies move to other countries, firing their employees along the way without consequence. Not going to happen anymore. My opponent, on the other hand, has supported virtually every trade agreement that has been destroying our middle class. She supported NAFTA, and she supported China's entrance into the World Trade Organization, another one of her husband's colossal mistakes and disasters. She supported the job-killing trade deal with South Korea. She supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will not only destroy our manufacturing, but it will make America subject to the rulings of foreign governments, and it's not going to happen. I pledge to never sign any trade agreement that hurts our workers or that diminishes our freedom and our independence. We will never, ever sign bad trade deals. America first again. America first. Instead, I will make individual deals with individual countries. No longer will we enter into these massive transactions with many countries that are thousands of pages long and which no one from our country even reads or understands. We are going to enforce all trade violations against any country that cheats. This includes stopping China's outrageous theft of intellectual property, along with their illegal product dumping and their devastating currency manipulation. They are the greatest that ever came about. They are the greatest currency manipulators ever. Our horrible trade agreements with China and many others will be totally renegotiated. That includes renegotiating NAFTA to get a much better deal for America, and we'll walk away if we don't get that kind of a deal. Our country is going to start building and making things again. Next comes the reform of our tax laws, regulations, and energy rules. While Hillary Clinton plans a massive, and I mean massive, tax increase, I have proposed the largest tax reduction of any candidate who has run for president this year, Democrat or Republican. middle-income Americans and businesses will experience profound relief, and taxes will be greatly simplified for everyone. I mean everyone. America is one of the highest tax nations in the world. Reducing taxes will cause new companies and new jobs to come roaring back into our country. Believe me, it'll happen, and it'll happen fast. Then we're going to deal with the issue of regulation, one of the greatest job killers of them all. Excessive regulation is costing our country as much as $2 trillion a year, and we will end it very, very quickly. We are going to lift the restrictions on the production of American energy. This will produce more than $20 trillion in job-creating economic activity over the next four decades. My opponent, on the other hand, wants to put the great miners and the great steelworkers of our country out of work and out of business. That will never happen with Donald J. Trump as president. Our steelworkers and our miners are going back to work again. With these new economic policy, trillions and trillions of dollars will start flowing into our country. This new wealth will improve the quality of life for all Americans. We will build the roads, highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, and the railways of tomorrow. This, in turn, will create millions of more jobs. We will rescue kids from failing schools by helping their parents send them to a safe school of their choice. My opponent would rather protect bureaucrats than serve American children. And that's what she's doing, and that's what she's done. We will repeal and replace disastrous Obamacare. You will be able to choose your own doctor again. And we will fix TSA at the airports, which is a total disaster. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to work with all of our students who are drowning in debt to take the pressure off these young people just starting out in their adult lives. Tremendous problem. We will completely rebuild our depleted military. And the countries that we are protecting at a massive cost to us will be asked to pay their fair share. We will take care of our great veterans like they have never been taken care of before. My just released 10-point plan has received tremendous veteran support. We will guarantee those who serve this country will be able to visit the doctor or hospital of their choice without waiting 5 days on a line and dying. My opponent dismissed the VA scandal. One more sign of how out of touch she really is. We are going to ask every department head in government to provide a list of wasteful spending on projects that we can eliminate in my first 100 days. The politicians have talked about this for years, but I'm going to do it. To appoint justices of the United States Supreme Court who will uphold our laws and our Constitution. The replacement of our beloved Justice Scalia will be a person of similar views, principles, and judicial philosophies. Very important. This will be one of the most important issues decided by this election. My opponent wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. I, on the other hand, received the early and strong endorsement of the National Rifle Association and will protect the right of all Americans to keep their families safe. At this moment, I would like to thank the evangelical and religious community because I'll tell you what, the support that they've given me, and I'm not sure I totally deserve it, has been so amazing and has had such a big reason for me being here tonight. True. So true. They have much to contribute to our politics, yet our laws prevent you from speaking your minds from your own pulpits. An amendment pushed by Lyndon Johnson many years ago threatens religious institutions with a loss of their tax-exempt status if they openly advocate their political views. Their voice has been taken away. I am going to work very hard to repeal that language and to protect free speech for all Americans. We can accomplish these great things and so much more. All we need to do is start believing in ourselves and in our country again. Start believing. It is time to show the whole world that America is back, bigger and better and stronger than ever before. In this journey, I'm so lucky to have at my side my wife, Melania, and my wonderful children, Don, Ivanka, Eric, Tiffany, and Barron. You will always be my greatest source of pride and joy. And by the way, Melania and Ivanka, did they do a job? My dad, Fred Trump, was the smartest and hardest working man I ever knew. I wonder sometimes what he'd say if he were here to see this and to see me tonight. It's because of him that I learned from my youngest age to respect the dignity of work and the dignity of working people. He was a guy most comfortable in the company of bricklayers and carpenters and electricians. And I have a lot of that in me also. I love those people. Then there's my mother, Mary. She was strong, but also warm and fair-minded. She was a truly great mother. She was also one of the most honest and charitable people that I have ever known, and a great, great judge of character. She could pick them out from anywhere. To my sisters, Mary Ann and Elizabeth, my brother, Robert, and my late brother, Fred, I will always give you my love. You are most special to me. I have had a truly great life in business. But now, my sole and exclusive mission is to go to work for our country, to go to work for you. It's time to deliver a victory for the American people. We don't win anymore, but we are going to start winning again. But to do that, we must break free from the petty politics of the past. America is a nation of believers, dreamers, and strivers that is being led by a group of censors, critics, and cynics. Remember, all of the people telling you you can't have the country you want are the same people that wouldn't stand. I mean, they said Trump doesn't have a chance of being here tonight. Not a chance. The same people. Oh, we love defeating those people, don't we? Don't we love defeating those people? Love it, love it, love it. No longer can we rely on those same people in the media and politics who will say anything to keep our rigged system in place. Instead, we must choose to believe in America. History is watching us now. We don't have much time, but history is watching. It's waiting to see if we will rise to the occasion and if we will show the whole world that America is still free and independent and strong. I am asking for your support tonight so that I can be your champion in the White House, and I will be your champion. My opponent asks her supporters to recite a three-word loyalty pledge. It reads, I'm with her. I choose to recite a different pledge. My pledge reads, I'm with you, the American people. I am your voice. So to every parent who dreams for their child and every child who dreams for their future, I say these words to you tonight. I am with you. I will fight for you and I will win for you. To all Americans tonight, in all of our cities and in all of our towns, I make this promise. We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
It was an awful lot to get through. Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention, Justin, a lot said.
Wow. big speech tonight. I just read on Twitter that it is the longest speech since 1972. In studio with me, Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson. Listen to the whole speech here. A surprising speech, as he really did sort of go through the exhaustive list of the things that he would like to see changed or what he's going to run on come this campaign.
A lot of it had the ring of a State of the Union address, where you go through the full list of the things you want to do. Mm-hmm. It ran too long. It was very strong. The phrase that I kept thinking of with all the hyperbole that was in it, it's going to happen right now, I'm going to get it done, believe me, was this was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. That was President Obama, and as you may have noticed, the oceans are not rising more slowly and the planet is not healing. So I don't think he's unique in this hyperbole.
Chris Roebling, what did you think of the speech?
Well, I think this is his most presidential speech since he declared 14 or 15 months ago in June of 2015. So I think that Hillary Clinton realizes that Donald Trump can deliver the goods. I mean, and he got to places in this speech where he has not been on the primary and caucus trail. He got specific about tax policy. He got a lot more specific about trade policy. He got very specific about immigration policy.
But for he's all really that locked into those.
For those, for all that specifics, the other things that sort of were vague and hyperbole, when I become president, there's going to be no more crime. You know, things like that where you're just
you don't
like,
think that's going to happen?
I don't think that's going to happen. But oh. I wonder how much the American people are picking up the specifics of tax policy or others when there's hyperbole that's
do
so
broad. Do you think
broad.
At this point, do you think the American people or any people anywhere on earth at this point, given what we've been through for 8 years, would be looking at it that way? Of course not. Come on, Justin.
And but it's been characteristic of his whole approach. I would just say this would have been a much better speech if it had been 25 minutes shorter.
Well,
I also think
would say 15.
I also
15
think
20,
it would be a much better speech if spoken by somebody else. And what I mean by Donald Trump's inflection, his style, the way he delivers the words, and he gets grovelly at certain points, it's a little too much in the sense that it just feels like he's shouting.
His daughter was very modulated and very controlled, and
she was great,
and
yeah.
also very well enunciated, and she had something substantive to say. She was conveying things about women's policies right. and about the concerns of working women. And as a 34-year-old working mother of three, now, obviously, she has advantages, and she acknowledged that. She said, I know I've been very privileged, and I bear that in mind. But she's still thinking about the plight of others. I said during this speech to the two of you, and I repeat now, I don't think that the mainstream media caricature of Donald Trump was validated by the Donald Trump that we saw in that 58 or 63 minute speech.
I agree with you in that, in the sense that I think there's so many times that we'll pick out the talking points or even some of the buffoonery, or even as we saw in some of the broadcasts that we were watching, the one protester who interrupted and spending way too much time watching the protester.
ABC with that protester to the
bitter end. Idea of having this long of a speech and Donald Trump to be able to lay out what his plan is, what his platform is, and what his strategy is, I agree with you that is different than the caricature that has been presented by the mainstream media.
But he has played into that caricature. He's the one who talked about the Mexican judge, a federal judge, and in any case, a person born in Indiana. He's done a lot of the ad hominem attacks. He doesn't say that this argument is wrong. He says you're bald. I mean, you know, that those kinds of things are a problem. He did deliver the speech in a kind of monotone, that or a one level of kind of shouting. When he actually moved off that and began to speak a little more quietly about real things, people who'd been killed, the things he was being touched by personally, the speech had a lot more impact.
Now, there's another dimension to this, which I think is going to take a little bit of reflection, and that is, he has moved the Republican Party, okay? And he is accepting, he is open to the LGBTQ community.
He said that with the same authority that he did.
He made a huge outreach there, and the crowd responded, and he then thanked the crowd for responding. And I think that you did not see harshness. You did not see culture war, social agendaism. What you saw was a guy who is principally focused on the common weal, the day in, day out concerns.
I also noticed later in the speech, he got at Hillary Clinton, he got at Democrats as well. But early on in that speech, it wasn't Democrats, it was politicians. He wasn't talking specifically about Democrats have ruined this country. He talked about politicians, and that's both sides of the aisle. He doesn't seem to be a friend of the Bush family and what happened in the years before President Obama. So it does seem that he's looking to really unite the country around the idea that politicians are bad.
Right. Well, this is dance with the one who brung you. I mean, that's how he got there. So I think that he was quite smart in doing all that. I thought the one interesting portion of this speech was a direct appeal to blacks and Hispanics on the issue of jobs. If he can make any inroads, if that, and on school choice, if those issues actually resonate, then that's important for him. On the other hand, those communities may feel that the attacks That the law and order is a code word mm-hmm. for them. I'm not saying what he means,
or that the immigration
issue is not just about illegal immigrants, but it's about all Hispanics. This is a crucial issue in the coming campaign.
Chris Roebling, Charles Lipson in studio with me. We'll continue our conversation. We'll add Dave Lundy to the mix, who's in studio. He just showed up here, so we'll be able to give a different perspective as well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Live coverage of the Republican National Convention and Donald Trump's speech. Stay with us. We continue our conversation tonight, obviously responding and reacting, a little analysis to the speech Donald Trump gave in front of the Republican National Convention, accepting the nomination for candidate for president. Chris Roebling in studio, Charles Lipson, as well as Dave Lundy, who's made his way over, the better half of Touche.
Thank you, Justin.
You should hear what he's saying. You're not in the studio.
Hold on a second. Hey.
You know, you're not supposed to say that while he's actually in the studio.
Both the guys here, Dave Lundy. Let me ask you, from a Democrat side, what did you think of Donald Trump's speech tonight?
Well, you know, for the first 4 hours, Justin, honestly, Trump painted a picture of a dystopian America. Trump painted this picture of an America that is completely befallen with every manner of evil and every manner of ill, and nobody has any ability to get anything done, and we're in the middle of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this and I'm going like, what America does he live in? Because we have real problems in this country, real challenges, but the picture he portrayed is so negative and so outrageously disconnected from reality. I don't know how it went over that.
I know you turned to your chauffeur and said, this is just wrong.
No, Charles, Chris. I turned to my driver. The chauffeur was unavailable tonight because he was getting my illegal drugs in from Mexico.
Let me bring Chris in. You know, one thing we talked about while the speech was going on, but one of the things I thought was interesting is that Donald Trump really laid at the feet of Hillary Clinton terrorism, poverty, ISIS, violence in this country. Is it warranted that President Obama and Hillary Clinton, they're the reason for those ills? Because it seems like those are things that have been affecting us for decades.
Well, I think that he was pretty specific. I think he was a lot more specific in his attack on Hillary Clinton than we have heard him be throughout this period of caucuses and primaries. I think that he was talking about Syria. He was talking about Libya. He was getting down to brass tacks. And I think he's laying down markers that are going to be exploited in the rhetoric between here and Election Day. He is holding her accountable for her record of failure.
More than 70% of the country in polls says the country's on the wrong track. That's what he's trying to tie into. On the other hand, President Obama is actually personally popular. So there are some attacks that you can do on President Obama that will resonate, but I think he mostly wants to say these are policies that have gone wrong. Tie Hillary to it.
Yeah, you didn't hear him say Obama. I don't even know if
he Obama was mentioned, but you also heard. Yeah, I think you heard very clearly from him that it was Hillary's judgment and Hillary's lack of execution. And I think this is going to come back, and I think these are soft spots for Hillary Clinton.
And I would just say that when you focus on things that actually resonate with people that are real, it tends to be more effective. And when you paint an over-the-top picture where the point you were getting at was that the things he accuses her of, where there are issues, where I might even agree with Chris that there were issues around Libya, for example. But he basically blames her for everything from the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby to the stock market crash. And it's just absurd and over the top. And I wonder how well that's going to resonate. You know, first of all, the fact checkers are having a field day even as we speak.
Right.
It was insane. But, you know, we have the last word. The Democrats have the last word next week. And I don't think that when push
comes
to
shove. Well, next week won't be the last word, believe me.
No, but between the conventions before you, you know.
Well, let me ask you guys this, because the one thing that I did think that Donald Trump hit on was his experience as a businessman and the ability, and not a politician. We talked about what a strong point for him was in the first 100 days of my presidency. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to root out all the things we're wasting money on. Politicians have promised us over the years and they can't get it done. I can get it done. That's the one area, and it may be just because he had a show that was what he did on television. That's the one area you go, I think Donald Trump could probably do that. That felt like it was in his wheelhouse. A lot of the other stuff, like I'm going to get rid of crime or I'm going to make this safety will be restored, it's just hyperbole.
I think the law and order, I think you raise a very important issue. I think people, he does things that are concrete. He didn't make his billions as a hedge fund manager. He built real buildings. And so that part of it, I think, gives him an edge. But I think this law and order issue can resonate. But Dave's point about things being over the top, it's not just the overpromising. It's that if law and order begins to sound authoritarian, and a lot of the tone of the speech was sounding authoritarian, then it begins to scare people. It sounds like order is being imposed by the center. By the same token, he did make some statements about justice and everybody being treated fairly. He needs to temper the law and order message consistently with those claims.
Well, in the warm and fuzzy words that he spoke to start the speech so quickly became comical because they were so disconnected from everything else that he said. And again, I honestly was vacillating between Il Duce and Hitler. It was just it was this capturing, trying to manipulate the public mood, and it tied in for me with this entire week. You know, the lock her up, the incitement, the intensity of the anger that he's stoking in
Don't
these fires.
Cry for I me, David Lundy.
I think that you heard something from him tonight that has been brewing since the beginning, and that is fusing the immigration issue with the law and order issue. And
right.
I think that he was devastating to the Obama Clinton or to the Obama administration, whatever you want to say, about these victims, okay, of violent crime perpetrated by folks who are here
and
illegally.
The sanctuary city issue.
And then bringing Hillary in as a supporter. And this is what I've sat with the family of this young lady who was viciously murdered by an illegal, undocumented person. And Hillary wants sanctuary cities. Now, I have to tell you that I understand David is reciting to us his inner psychological reaction and how he is trying to look at Trump and see Il Duce. Okay, that's for David and all of his friends to deal with. What we are dealing with in reality is a situation in this country that is actually causing people to compare it to 1968, one of the most challenging years in our history and in the West's history since World War II.
But he can be reelected. He can be elected, perhaps, as Nixon, but not as Agnew.
That is an excellent point, because the speech started as Nixon, the law and order stuff. I wrote that. I tweeted out, you know, Nixon 2016. And it quickly went from Nixon south. And I hadn't thought of Agnew, but you're exactly right. And far be it for me to be the nattering nabob of negativism, but it was a dark, dark
speech. I think, David, that's to you and that's to your friends who are watching it with you. I don't think you guys are ready for what's coming at you. And I'm saying, look at the 16 Republicans who fell, okay, to the scythe of Donald Trump. And I don't think that Hillary, I don't think the Democrats, I don't think the liberals, I don't think the highly educated, very powerful insider liberals like David and his friend, I don't think they, I honestly think, David, seriously, you don't get it.
But is this similar to what happened in 2008, do you think, where Republicans were like,
no,
we don't understand
that,
Obama,
no.
And Obama just kind of steamrolled?
No, 2008 was a very different situation, in my opinion. I believe in 2008 we were war-weary, we were just sick of the whole thing, and you had this bright face, this bright young guy who looked and sounded just terrific.
Who was giving an alternative.
And, right. and it was very easy to go for him and not for John McCain, who's big credential. I'm a war hero.
You're sounding very similar to what's happening in 2016. You have a new, fresh face, regardless if it's not Donald Trump. And you have Hillary Clinton, who's been around for
the block. But where's the alternative? Because we kept waiting for it. The entire week up until today, there has been nothing forward-looking, nothing other than assertions, and not even very many assertions. And tonight, Trump's speech, you know, you kept asking, how are you going to do that? And I kept doing this. And you for our radio listeners, right. I'm waving my hand like a magic wand.
Well, of course, it's like something like maybe hope and change. Right, but David. it's a change.
Jeez, Louise, David.
See, the reason that there was a bit of a missed opportunity in the speech, it's a change election, but people are frightened to go with Trump because of certain things. He should have tamped that down, and instead he reinforced it.
I'm going to say that Trump and his family did the best at the convention. Manafort should be replaced probably by Roger Ailes tomorrow afternoon because the rest of the convention wasn't nearly – there were a few shining moments, but not many.
Chris Roebling, we get the last word. Chris Roebling, Charles Lipson, I can't thank you guys enough for being down here and being a part of this broadcast all week long. I appreciate you guys coming in studio, watching the speech together. Dave Lundy, you are going to the Democratic Convention this week, so we'll check in with you. It's time for you to pass the baton from Chris and Charles to Dave Lundy for the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia next week.
Yay, our week! Woohoo! And I'm going to be sticking around with Patty for a bit.
All right, there you go. All right, so we'll take a break here. And we'll wrap things up. Stay with us. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Time for Patty Vasquez to continue the conversation about the speech tonight, Donald Trump's speech. And Patty coming up here. Dave Lundy's going to stick around. So keep it 720 WGN.